Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Scott Brown, and I drive a truck.
Democrats this morning feel like they got hit by that truck.
If you do not run, you cannot win. And you don't always win all of the time, but you put in your best efforts because sometimes it's more important to travel hopefully than to arrive.
Massachusetts voters fire a shot heard round the political world. And 1 year to the day after he took the oath of office, President Obama has arrived at a political dead end. Where to now? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, Wednesday, January 20th. I'm Miles O'Brien in New York City all week for Celeste Headlee on vacation. John Hockenberry joins me from Washington, D.C. Good morning, John.
Hey, Miles, that DeMartha Coakley sounded very zen there. It's all about the journey. We don't need to arrive.
Yes, indeed.
Well, the other top stories this morning, let's get right to them. Strong aftershock rocked Haiti this morning, just as much-needed medical aid was set to reach the earthquake-ravaged nation. The 6.1 quake struck a little after 6 a.m. Eastern time. Earlier on the program, we spoke with Christian Fraser, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, who was on the ground in Haiti when today's quake hit.
It wasn't so much the shaking that woke me up, it was the screaming and the sheer sound of terror.
The USS Comfort will arrive in a few hours to Port-au-Prince. It's a major hospital facility with the capacity to work with 1,000 patients at one time. U.S. helicopters will ferry patients aboard, bringing relief to overloaded hospitals and clinics on land. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he's sending more ships to help with the earthquake recovery. In a stunning upset that reshapes the political landscape, as Miles was talking about moments ago, Republican Scott Brown has won the U.S. Senate seat in Massachusetts. Brown defeated Martha Coakley in a special election for Ted Kennedy's old Senate seat in what could be a devastating blow to President Obama's domestic agenda. This morning on the Today Show, Brown said Democrats will pay a price if they try to manipulate a health care vote now.
They use some political chicanery, and they do it without having a go back and forth with proper votes. I think coming the midterm elections, people will be very, very concerned, and they'll remember.
All right. Why is it a devastating blow to President Obama's domestic agenda? It's just one state, one senator, after all. Joining us right now is Eric Euland. He worked as a top aide for Senate GOP leadership for 18 years. He's now the vice president of the Duberstein Group, a Washington-based lobbying firm. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you?
All right, so that is a smile on your face that I'm hearing?
It's a bit of a grin. Here's why it's a devastating blow. In the Senate of the United States, you need 60 votes in order to get anything done. With Scott Brown's election last night, of course, now Democrats and those affiliated with Democrats in the Senate only have 59 votes. So for starters, the automatic ability to move legislation through the Senate, Obama's priorities are suddenly in deep question.
Eric Euland is going to stay with us, and we'll talk about this disturbing milestone 1 year after the Obama inauguration.
Word is coming in this past half hour. President Obama's choice to lead the Transportation Security Administration is withdrawing his nomination. In a statement, Errol Southers says he's withdrawing because his nomination has become a lightning rod for those with a political agenda. As many as three dozen Americans who converted to Islam in prison may have traveled to Yemen, possibly to train with al-Qaeda. That's according to a Senate report that cites law enforcement officials. According to the report, it's believed some of the individuals have, and we quote now, dropped off the radar, and they continue to carry U.S. passports.
That's disturbing. Bank of America says in another disturbing report it lost over $5 billion during the last 3 months. Two tough years in a row for Bank of America. It lost over $2 billion last year. Asian and European markets are down this morning. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,725 in about a half hour. S&P 1150. The Nasdaq opens at 2320. Coming up, you want to hear a conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the New York Times bestseller Eat, Pray, Love.
Also, what does Scott Brown's victory mean to the National Democratic Party? We'll discuss that with some takeaway political experts in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry in Washington, D.C. this week, here with Miles O'Brien up in New York, who's in for Celeste Headlee, vacationing all this week. Well, as we said, the Senate seat held for nearly half a century by Ted Kennedy has been won by Republican candidate Scott Brown.
There's no replacing a man like that, but tonight I honor the memory and I pledge to be the very best and try to be a worthy successor to the late Senator Kennedy.
Yes, you'd have to go back to 1972 to find a time when the Senate seat in Massachusetts was held by a Republican. And really, Scott Brown was able to effectively take advantage of sentiments like these at the polling stations. Here's the voice of one voter collected by Jared Bowen, a producer with our member station and partner WGBH in Boston.
Healthcare, don't like what they're doing at all. I think it's a big sham. She's going to vote for it. He isn't. We'll see what happens.
Well, what did happen was the she in that clip there, Martha Coakley, went down to defeat. Democrat candidate Martha Coakley defeated by Scott Brown. The victory is a major loss for Democrats. And as Eric Euland mentioned at the top of the hour, the reason this is significant for the Barack Obama agenda is that it deprives the Democrats of that 60-vote. 60-vote majority is going to be necessary to pass health care reform. Where does that go now? Well, we want to talk about that with Eric Euland. He worked as a top aide for Senate GOP leadership for 18 years and is currently the vice president of the Duberstein Group, a Washington-based lobbying firm. Eric, you're still with us, right?
Yes, indeed.
And sitting next to me here in Washington, takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, it seems to me just inconceivable that the Obama administration would allow this to happen. I mean, it was their decision to focus on the 60-vote majority on health care. I mean, as Eric says, you need it, but to make it the centerpiece, to actually put it front and center in your legislative agenda, really handed the Republicans an opportunity to snatch this away from them, don't you think?
It seems like the Democrats may have been blinded by their own sunshine. The sun shone so bright when they had a 60-vote majority that they were possibly blinded to the, you know, to the scenario of losing it. So healthcare is extremely complicated now. They still have opportunities to pass it. The scenario that we've been talking about, John, for about 2 weeks, that they may still try to pass a House-Senate deal in the Senate before Scott Brown can be seated, that was still a possibility last night until about 20 minutes after Martha Coakley conceded. And a Democrat, Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, issued a statement saying, we should take no more votes on health care until Scott Brown is seated. It doesn't uphold the, I'm paraphrasing, it doesn't uphold the integrity of the Senate if we do that. So this is a Democrat and a moderate Democrat from a purple state sending signals to the Democratic leadership. Don't try this strategy of voting again on this high-profile issue before Scott Brown is seated. So now they have to think up something else, sending a Senate bill over to the House. They got to think up a new scenario now. Things are very complicated.
Well, I was over in the West Wing last night, and there were boxes and boxes of food being brought in. It was going to be a late night there. Todd Zwillick suggests it's back to square one for the Democrats on health care. Eric Euland, do you agree with that, and is there even a square one?
Well, that's a good question this morning, whether or not there's a square one. As a fallback to coming up with the deal and then passing it again through the House and the Senate, there's also conversation this morning about possibly the House simply passing the Senate bill, which was adopted in the Senate there Christmas Eve, and then coming back at some point in the not-too-distant future and using a fast-track legislative process in the Congress called reconciliation to make final changes to the legislation which are being negotiated over at the White House. As Todd said, that's incredibly complicated, and given the political rot which is set in around health care, the issue of health care, that's an open question whether or not the Democratic majority will be able to pull that off as well.
Well, it seems to me the electorate in Massachusetts, and if you add the electorate in Virginia, where there was a reversal for the Democrats in November, and also in New Jersey, where there was a reversal for the Democrats in the State House, there's no more patience for procedural shenanigans for Pelosi and Reid on health care. Maybe what's been done here is a momentum play to the Republicans that the GOP can now pick up health care and go, relax, guys, we'll take care of this. Eric Euland, what's the chance of that?
Well, there's every possibility of that as well. Obviously, Democrats have been talking about this issue for a long time, but so have Republicans. But, John, here's a good point. I mean, if you look at the trend line of what's happened here in the last several election cycles, independents really prove out as a controlling factor. So in 2002 and 2004, independents stuck with Republicans. led to their majorities in 06 and 08, helped return Democratic control to the Congress and then elect Barack Obama. But in 09, both those gubernatorial races, and now here the first race of 2010, the independents stuck with the Republicans. So whether it's health care or a variety of other domestic policy initiatives the president has on his plate for 2010, the question really comes to the White House and the Democratic majority. Do we stick with the independents, the people who brought us to town, who have real concerns about overspending and excessive government activity here, or do we continue down the path of attempting to satisfy our base on issues like financial re-regulation, climate change, immigration, and the like?
Well, Eric Uhland, I got to ask you, and very quickly before we go, I mean, do you and Republican leadership smell a 1994 reversal, and is Scott Brown sort of the star leading that charge?
Well, he's definitely the star, but it's too early yet to predict a 1994 reversal. Nevertheless, Republicans are looking at a lot of pickup opportunities, and Democrats are extremely nervous about retaining control of the House this morning.
Said with a smile on his face. I can hear it there. Eric Uhland worked as a top aide for Senate GOP leadership for 18 years. He's vice president of the Duberstein Group, Washington-based lobbying firm. Take us out, Todd, real quick.
Democrats, I would disagree with one thing that Eric said. Not necessarily that Democrats think they have to keep going with their base. A lot of Democrats think Barack Obama has ignored his base on labor, on gay rights. And there are a lot of Democrats who say, go hard to the base. That's how you win. You went milquetoast. That's why you lost.
Well, that was some truck up there in Massachusetts anyway. Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. And speaking of truck, Jay, why don't you take us out with the Grateful Dead, okay?
What a long, strange trip it's been.
My name is Scott Brown, and I'm running for the United States Senate. This is my truck.
Back up that truck and drive it right down the wall.
Driving around in Massachusetts in a truck.
And it all started with me, my truck.
He's driving his truck around the Commonwealth.
Let me tell you, when he started to criticize my truck, that's where I draw the line.
I'm Scott Brown, and I drive a truck.
We call it radio at 15 minutes after the hour. Let's check in on the headlines that we're following this morning. Miles?
The U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says al-Qaeda is trying to destabilize the whole of South Asia and could try to provoke a war between Pakistan and India. Speaking during a visit to India, Mr. Gates said this morning al-Qaeda was an umbrella organization for the Taliban in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's been a strong aftershock in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince this morning as rescue teams continue to search for survivors of the earthquake. There are no immediate reports of casualties, however. We spoke to BBC reporter Christian Fraser, who's on the ground in Haiti. He said it was unclear how much new damage had been caused.
But I know from people who are coming back from the airport that buildings that were standing this morning before the earthquake, they have collapsed.
Meanwhile, aid teams are still searching for survivors from the first quake more than a week ago. In the past few hours, an elderly woman has been pulled from the rubble alive. Back at home, Massachusetts Senate seat formerly held by Democrat Ted Kennedy has gone to a Republican. Here's the winner, Scott Brown, on NBC this morning.
We already have 98% of our people insured here already in Massachusetts. We do not need the plan that's being pushed upon us. We would have lesser care, longer lines, and pay higher taxes, and it makes no sense.
The win gives Republicans a better chance at halting pending health care legislation.
President Obama's choice to lead the Transportation Security Administration is withdrawing his nomination, we learned this morning in a statement. Eric Southers says he is withdrawing because his nomination has become a lightning rod for those with what he calls a political agenda. Coming up, we're going to be looking at the Senate election, what it means for politics nationally. That's what we're watching this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our takeouts this morning are focusing on the one-year anniversary of President Obama's inauguration. For the view outside the Beltway, we're joined by two friends of the Takeaway, Susanna Capiluto, the news director at Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Adam Ellington, a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Susanna, good to have you with us. We'll start with you, ladies first. You're in Atlanta, a place I know well, a little pinprick of blue and a sea of red there. What are they thinking of the president these days?
Well, these days, the president is not quite as popular as he used to be in Atlanta. He still, of course, has a strong base here, but outside of Atlanta, it's a different story. And, you know, here people just hope, you know, they have this protective attitude. You know, they say, look, it's only been a year. Give the guy a chance. He inherited a lot of problems. So that's one attitude. On the other hand, we have 10% unemployment. Things are just not turning around as fast, so there is sort of this flickering of dissent.
So what does he have to do? Provide more jobs? Is that what it's all about? How will he curry favor with voters in Atlanta?
Well, with his base in Atlanta, I think what needs to happen is health care reform. If that fails, it's going to be devastating. And the other thing is really the economy has to turn around. Jobs have to come. And things have to turn around, I think, for the president to really, you know, gain some respect again, I guess, from his base here.
All right, Susanna, let's go to Adam Ellington in St. Louis. Adam, Obama lost Missouri by a narrow margin. What if the election were today? What would happen there?
Well, if the election were today, I'm sure he would lose by much more. I think the situation on the ground here in St. Louis is that Obama's base just feels kind of deflated. They were really excited and energized when he took office, and they were hoping for swift and broad change on various fronts, which didn't happen. And now over the summer, state Republicans have sort of really gone to town on the, you know, with the healthcare town halls in Missouri and kept that fervor going and are still hammering away at healthcare opposition in our state.
Yeah, Adam, there's a lot of moving parts to this. There's the whole Tea Party movement. There's the economy.
Right.
There's the healthcare issue. A lot of factors going in there. Try to figure out what the main factor is, if you can.
Oh, it's definitely healthcare, I think, at this point, that's at least driving the opposition to the president's agenda. There's a legislative bill in the General Assembly right now that aims to opt Missouri out of mandatory insurance coverage if that is what is passed in Congress. And that bill has gotten a lot of support among state Republicans, and I think they're planning on using it. It's fair to say they're planning on using it as the red meat issue this coming year in our own U.S. Senate election. So it's really become the new guns or the gay marriage issue for state Republicans here.
So this is going to have a big impact on the midterm elections, clearly.
Oh yeah, in Missouri, this is going to be a big thing. We've got a U.S. Senate seat up for grabs, and that's going to be the main issue.
Adam Ellington, reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Susanna Capiluto with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thanks.
So what a different landscape. A year ago, the mall was crowded with enthusiastic Obama supporters on a very, very cold morning. This morning, spring-like temperatures in Washington, but politically, it's very, very chilly. We decided to get some voices of people in Washington to think back of this first year of the Obama administration. Here's a couple of those voices. The enthusiasm was a little hard to find when we were out yesterday. Let's start with Alem Namara, who we met at a carousel along the mall in Washington.
I run this carousel and the popcorn wagon around the mall. I never seen anything like that in my life. I'm not happy the way it's going on, but still it's too early to tell that he cannot accomplish what he promised.
Breonna Rawlings and Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Yes, I did. I had a lot of expectations for him, especially if he was going to be the first African-American president. He's going to have a lot of expectations from a lot of people.
My name is Nika Rawlings, and I live in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I'm completely confused about the whole uproar over the healthcare situation because, for me, I know people that don't have healthcare, so it seems like to me that for us to try to get something done is absolutely wonderful. So for these people to say this is absolutely ridiculous and the wrong way to go and all that, it's like, well, what about those people who don't have healthcare? I bet you have healthcare.
So there were some young people who President Obama most definitely inspired last year who we caught up with who were having difficulty finding that inspiration yesterday.
I was not of voting age when the election came around, but I did actively volunteer to campaign for Obama. I'm definitely pleased with some of the things that have happened in the last year. I can't say that I've been 100% pleased with the way that he addressed healthcare reform and kind of not taking that leadership that he took with the economic stimulus package.
I mainly just had hope in the fact that I felt that he could truly like bring our country together. And I don't think that's really happening right now. I know the healthcare legislature's going, you know, a little slow. But I still have hope in the guy. I would just like to see him kind of bring Congress together. And I mean, I know that's almost impossible to do, but like nothing's getting done.
Voices of Sean Cushing and Matteo Ferraro, both students at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So the best vantage point at the inauguration last year, does anyone recall? Those vendors hawking Obama memorabilia. And what's the stock of those hero T-shirts 1 year on?
My name is Sam June. I work a vendor here since 1982. After a year, and still we still have popular items for Mr. Obama president. Yeah, hope. And Superman. See the Superman pictures over there?
If you see Superman, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Coming up in the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti, what is the best way to help the orphans of Haiti, whose number has more than doubled since last week's devastating earthquake? We'll discuss that in a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're going to give you an update on a little over 2 hours ago, that magnitude 6.1 aftershock which hit Haiti. And here are some of the other news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. That powerful aftershock struck Haiti just over 2 hours ago, and soon after it struck, BBC correspondent Christian Fraser in Port-au-Prince joined us. And he said that the buildings had actually collapsed near the airport, although we don't have an official assessment of additional damage. Last week's magnitude 7 earthquake killed an estimated 200,000 people, injured 250,000, and left 1.5 million homeless.
Here at home, Republican Scott Brown pulled off one of the biggest upsets in Massachusetts political history last night, defeating Democrat Martha Coakley to become the state's next U.S. senator. Brown tells NBC News voters are unhappy in his state and elsewhere.
People are angry. They're tired of the backroom deals. They want transparency. They want good government. They want fairness. And they want people to start working and solving their problems.
Along with becoming the first Republican senator from the state in nearly 30 years, Brown's election potentially derails President Obama's hopes for a health care overhaul. The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick says Democrats are divided on what to do next.
Senator Jim Webb of Virginia issued a statement saying we should take no more votes on health care until Scott Brown is seated. It doesn't uphold the, I'm paraphrasing, it doesn't uphold the integrity of the Senate if we do that.
President Obama and congressional Democrats are now scrambling to find a plan B. The markets have just opened. The Dow is down 70, the S&P down about 8, the NASDAQ is down about 23. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Back to Haiti now. Another earthquake hit Haiti, as we mentioned. Within the last 2 hours, the U.S. Geological Survey says the epicenter was about 35 miles northwest of the capital of Port-au-Prince. Joining us now is Nick Davis from our partner, the BBC. Nick, good morning.
Good morning.
Did you feel the aftershock, and what sense do we have of what it's contributed or subtracted from the already significant devastation?
Well, it takes a few seconds to register what is going on. I was asleep, soundly asleep, I have to say, for the first time in probably about 7 days, when all of a sudden I felt the bed shaking, the ground underneath us moving. I quickly got up, decided to throw on a T-shirt. They tell you that the first thing you need to do in these situations is get out of the building, get away from walls. I think my T-shirt and me trying to get dressed quickly hampered me, because by the time I got out of the building, the courtyard was full of people. The Haitians here, very used to the scenario. They were very, very panic-stricken at the moment. they were looking around, just looking at the building just to make sure that nothing was going to fall from it. And that's the reality for people here. We've been getting reports that some buildings, I believe he said that my colleague Christian Fraser had said, a number of buildings near the airport had fallen. Not surprising when you think about the situation that the structural integrity of many of the buildings in this capital severely damaged, severely weakened, the ones which are still standing by last week's magnitude 7 quake.
All right, Nick Davis, our partner from the BBC. It will be a busy day today surveying the additional damage from that 6.1 aftershock. And in the wake of all of this, there are almost a million orphans in the nation of Haiti. 400,000 orphans were there in that country before the earthquake. Joining us to talk about the enormous scale of this problem, dealing with all the children, is Sarah Smith, Director of Children's Programs at the International Rescue Committee. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, the scale of this orphan problem in Haiti, give us a sense of that.
Well, as you said, it was huge to begin with, and now the scale is even more enormous. It is unclear exactly how many orphans there are in Haiti, and we are trying to get better estimates and better information, but there are certainly huge numbers of children who are either orphaned or have been separated from their family members and are trying to find them now.
And U.S. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley says that the U.S. is very much concerned about them and is making a massive effort to try to deal with it.
We are bending over backwards to try to protect and to as many children as possible in Haiti and move those that we can to get medical attention or on to their adoptive parents.
Now, moving Haitian children to so-called adoptive parents on a massive scale, what are your worries in a situation like that, Sarah Smith?
There are quite a few worries. First of all, I think the main concern is that children who are not prepared or in a place or appropriate for adoption would be moved. The process of identifying and registering children determining whether or not they are appropriate for adoption is a long process. And typically, in an emergency like this, adoption is not the first measure. The first measure is trying to identify known and safe families for children to stay within their communities. The ideal situation is to keep kids in a familiar surrounding with family members or with others that they know, and not to remove them from a familiar setting, because this just can increase their distress and make it harder for them to recover ultimately. So the challenge is just going through that process of identifying and registering children and identifying those who are appropriate for adoption.
Isn't there a danger of that, though, with the fragile and non-existent infrastructure inside Haiti of keeping children in a kind of a holding pattern, even if they are close to their sort of emotional connections?
Yes, it certainly isn't easy, and I think the international community and the child protection actors on the ground and working very closely with the Haitian government will put in place a process for doing this. I think the best holding pattern, though, for children is family-based care, and usually in situations like this, there are lots of families who perhaps have lost children of their own and are willing and very able to take care of children safely. There are also alternative care options that can be set up and safe spaces for children to stay. So there are options, and it's much better to keep them in those options than to move them to a place that might be unfamiliar or inappropriate for them.
Yeah, a U.S. official described the scale of the relief operation as needing to sustain a population of 3 million people on a more or less open-ended basis. If we just take the young people, the kid piece of this, what is the scale of what's going to have to be done in terms of sustaining people in Haiti or moving them to safer locations?
It's massive.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
The scale is huge, and as you said, the numbers are huge. I think estimates said that 40% of the population was under 14 years old. So there are huge numbers of children, and I think the good news is that the scale of the efforts is also huge. Thankfully, people are being incredibly generous, and there's a lot of funding and a lot of resources going into helping people and really serving children in particular.
But it's fair to say that the takeaway here is, even though the need is massive and the scale of the relief operation is massive, we shouldn't allow a massive effort to make draconian decisions that may result in things that we're going to regret years later, right?
Yes, that's certainly my take.
Sarah Smith is Director of Children's Programs at the International Rescue Committee, talking both about the scale and the complexity of the orphan problem in Haiti. Coming up, Elizabeth Gilbert gets committed. Her latest memoir, Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. That's coming up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien.
And I'm John Hockenberry, down here in Washington, D.C., where they're definitely mulling over what the voters of Massachusetts did yesterday. They elected Republican Scott Brown to fill Ted Kennedy's long-held Senate seat. We're asking you today, what did this election mean to politics nationally? Was it a referendum of the job President Obama's been doing in his first year in office? Is it a referendum on the Democratic agenda in general? What do you think, Mike from Rhode Island?
Massachusetts is definitely a referendum against the Obama administration. Obama went to Washington talking the talk of reform, but his walk is basically just cronyism politicians in Washington, more of the same. Heads up, more to come.
And here's what Devin from New Jersey had to say about our commander-in-chief.
I think Barack Obama is like the new guy on the job. Great work ethic, tell he's trying very hard. Just can be a little bit annoying. Maybe he just needs to find his groove.
Some voters have expressed more overt disappointment in the job the Obama administration's done so far. Here's Ryan, who works for a climate change nonprofit here in Washington, D.C. Ryan spoke with some of the takeaway team down here in Washington who hit the streets to collect voices on Obama 1 year later.
A year ago, I was hopeful for the new and progressive leadership that he represented for all of us and for a breakthrough in race relations for the United States. Today, I really don't think that he has pushed a very aggressive, progressive agenda. And I don't think that he's really actually given us much of a breakthrough politically, because he's using politics as usual.
And that was the theme. High hopes come down to earth. Here's Peter, another Washington, D.C. voice who felt let down.
War that, you know, and military action that we're involved in around the world, I think people expected more change. And I think people are a little bit kind of just wind has been taken out of the sail on those issues because he hasn't been forceful enough.
But not everyone in D.C. in our very unscientific sampling was quite so critical of the president's first year in office. Here's Nika.
You know, I knew that he is a human, that he could not come in and absolutely in one day, 1 year, even 4 years, be able to completely change the way our government works. That's impossible for anybody to do, let alone him. I mean, I think we put way too much expectation on one individual. It can't be done by one person. It has to be a collective.
And the next take came from Lester in Massachusetts, which is the eye of the storm, I guess, this morning. Lester says that it's less a referendum on the president or even the party, but a plea for more bipartisanship in government.
The reason why Scott Brown won was that he and many other people, including myself, don't want a juggernaut in Washington. 60 Democrats can basically take over the Senate and push through virtually any bills they want, and we really think that they need to try to build a coalition of all people, not just Democrats.
And this last caller has an ominous take for the president.
As Virginia goes, as New Jersey goes, and now as Massachusetts goes, Obama is going to go.
Talking about reversals in Virginia, New Jersey, and of course last night in Massachusetts, where Ted Kennedy's Senate seat went to a Republican. You can email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Lewis did just that and writes, it's a great day for the Democrats since the GOP cannot blame them anymore. What about you? What do you think? What do you think of the results in Massachusetts and the president going forward on this one-year anniversary? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org, where Todd Zwillick has a blog posted the options for Obama on health care.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien in New York, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation with John Hockenberry in D.C. this morning. Coming up, Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the New York Times bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, joins the show to talk about the inspiration behind her newest memoir. It's called Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Right now, here's a check of the leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Another earthquake hit Haiti this morning, shaking rubble from damaged buildings and sending people running into the streets. The magnitude 6.1 quake reportedly caused some unstable buildings to collapse. Meanwhile, American operations are being directed from the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson off the coast of Haiti. BBC correspondent Steve Kingstone is on the flight deck of the Carl Vinson talking to U.S. officers.
Well, I'm now standing on the deck of the USS Carl Vinson, this vast waterborne runway, one of the biggest aircraft carriers in the world. They're loading up bottles of water, ready meals, medical packs, which are then being flown on to Port-au-Prince. This really has become a second airport.
We've been doing the heavy lift, so moving large quantities of water and food. We've been doing runs back and forth between Guantanamo, Cuba, bringing naval supplies, and also from the ship, taking those into Port-au-Prince, either to the airfield or directly into the landing zones in the city.
That was BBC correspondent Steve Kingstone in with U.S. Officer Lieutenant Scott Tompkins.
As you can hear, the U.S. military is stepping up its efforts on land and on sea. The USS Comfort will arrive in a few hours to Port-au-Prince. That's a large hospital ship capable of treating 1,000 patients at a time. Back home, Republican Senator Scott Brown says he doesn't think his victory in Massachusetts was a referendum on President Obama. Here's what he had to say to NBC News this morning.
I think we should allow the states to do what's important for their own states, have the federal government incentivize those individual states. And while I believe everybody should have insurance, I initially have to look out for our state.
A states' rights message there from the new junior senator from Massachusetts. Scott Brown won yesterday's special election for the Senate seat held for decades by the late Ted Kennedy. Economic news. Construction of new homes dipped unexpectedly last month, falling 4% as bad weather hit much of the country. But applications for future projects soared 11% in a sign that the industry is ramping up. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Eat, pray, love, and then what? How do you follow up a book that spent 57 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list? That is the enviable dilemma author Elizabeth Gilbert faced as she got back to writing after such a stunning success. Eat, Pray, Love was a memoir that told the story of her emotional and physical journey after a crushing divorce. Why not another memoir, a sequel? This one about her reluctant entry into the world of matrimony a second time. The title is Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, very well. You got married to get a green card, essentially. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, at the end of my travels with Eat, Pray, Love, as readers of that book might remember, I fell in love with this lovely Brazilian gentleman, and we commenced to building a life together, and the only problem was that, you know, he wasn't a citizen of the United States, and we wanted to live here. And we were trying to get around that, but we had an unpleasant run-in with the Homeland Security Department at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, who essentially told us that we had no choice other than to get married if he wanted to be here. So it's sort of a shotgun wedding with the INS holding the other end of the shotgun.
Wow.
And the book is about my efforts to find a way to be comfortable with marriage after having been through such a bad divorce.
Yeah, it's interesting. You were committed to him, but you weren't committed to the institution of marriage. What's the difference?
Right. Well, the difference is one of the things you learn when you go through a divorce is that that promise that you make to each other on your wedding day is also extended into a contract that you enter into with the state. And when you try to disband a marriage and you have to wait for a couple of years to get permission from the state to be granted a divorce, you realize just how involved the government has become in your private life. And the fact that we didn't want to have children, and so we didn't feel we needed, you know, that legal sanction of marriage to protect the family, just made us feel like maybe we'd like to leave the government out of it. But unfortunately, you know, you can't have intimacy without privacy, and you can't have privacy without rights, and you can't have rights without some sort of state sanction. So we decided to go for it.
So how did you come to terms with this, lack of privacy or whatever you gave up in order to make it possible for you to come back to the U.S.?
Well, what I did was I spent, we spent 10 months out of the country trying to get back in on a fiancé visa, and I used that time to do absolutely nothing but study and contemplate the subject of matrimony and talk to everybody that I met when we were traveling around the world, waiting to get back into the United States, and read every book that I could have my historian sister ship me back from Philadelphia. And for one thing, I got a huge historical perspective on the idea of marriage, and it changed a bit my notion of it, because what I thought of as a very rigid, box-shaped social structure that's been passed down intact for thousands of years is actually, when you look at it closely, this ever-evolving liquid long-term social science experiment that has been changing and altering with every generation in order to stay relevant. You know, the obvious example of that being that none of us would accept marriage on its 14th century terms, not even the most conservative commentators in the world, you know. And so marriage changes, and the people who change it are those who are within it. You know, it's almost like we're each given tools as we enter into that couplehood, and we shape it from within. And when I saw it in that perspective, I started to think, okay, I'm part of this long evolving historical process. I'm not being crammed into this narrow, rigid box.
Well, I love your perspective, Elizabeth, and I'm a big fan of your work. And, you know, people shouldn't think that even though you're so brilliant, you're not romantic. You're very, very romantic. But In your perspective here, you have a unique, you can answer this question, probably no one else in the world can. Which is worse, divorce or Homeland Security at Fort Worth Airport?
You know what, after that encounter with the Homeland Security at Fort Worth Airport, I remember right before they handcuffed my sweetheart and took him to jail and then deported him, he grabbed me and he said, "I love you so much, I will even marry you." Because that's what it came down to in terms of romance. Like, oh,
boy, that's
I guess
true
we
love.
Have to do this.
Yeah.
You know so I guess the answer is Homeland Security is worse.
What's worse, though, for you as a writer, you wrote a lot of books before your success with Eat, Pray, Love that weren't as widely received, to say the least. You write in your book, interestingly, that when you wrote for a small audience, you said in one critical way, it was comforting. If I humiliated myself too atrociously, at least there wouldn't be many witnesses. And then you go on to say that you wrote this book with 27 women in mind. Was that the key, that you couldn't think about millions of people picking this book up?
Yeah, there is something intimidating about trying to write a book that will satisfy millions of people, especially if the books that you wrote before that were read by dozens and dozens of people. So I had to kind of go back to that smaller scale. So instead of writing committed for the whole world, I chose the 27 women in the world who are most important to me, my family, friends, relatives, and neighbors, who've all been having conversations about intimacy forever, and I wrote the book for them.
Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the New York Times bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, and maybe a new bestseller, Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Thanks for your time. Good luck with the book. You can check out an excerpt of Elizabeth Gilbert's new book on our website at thetakeaway.org.
I love that. Dozens and dozens. I think it's fair to say that more people read our website than dozens and dozens, right, Miles?
I think we've broadened our audience already, right there.
Yes, indeed. That was great. I love that scene at the airport. I think that should be in the movie if they ever option it.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yesterday, the voters of Massachusetts elected Republican Scott Brown to fill Ted Kennedy's long-held Senate seat. So all day we're asking, was the election a referendum of the job President Obama's been doing in his first full year in office? David from upstate New York says the president's critics just need to relax.
And I can't help but think that people just need to relax a little bit. He's only been in office for 1 year, and essentially he's trying to take on the world, which needs to be taken on.
Our next caller says, what's the big deal? Since when do we need a filibuster-proof majority to get things done?
You've got to think back to the Bush years. Bush never had a majority and was able to do essentially whatever he wanted. It's just incredibly frustrating, and it really supports the notion that the Democrats are kind of useless.
You know, Miles, I've been down here all week in Washington, or at least the last 2 days in Washington, and part of the White House Fellows Commission, and it's a bit of a fly on the wall. And a lot of the headlines that were coming out of people's mouths yesterday in the White House and up on Capitol Hill was that this is all about that 60 vote majority rule in the Senate, that's really the obstacle here, and maybe that's what's going to be debated going forward.
Right, and suddenly Olympia Snow takes center stage again or something, I guess, right?
Well, Todd Zwillick will have all of that. He's blogged on our website, what is the option for Barack Obama on health care reform now that this has all happened? What's your take? You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And boy, Scott Brown had a good week. Barack Obama had a bad week. I want to remind you of our new collaboration with The Week magazine, their witty week in review. Good week, bad week. It comes to our air every Friday. And you can nominate who's having a good week or a bad week. You call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.